Which is, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So, yeah, looking forward to hearing you. Thanks.
Father, use me as an instrument of your mercy and your peace so that I may help someone in the room tonight, and by doing so, help myself to stay sober another day. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Walt. You know, the funny thing is I never started out to be an alcoholic. I never really wanted to be an alcoholic. But I can tell you that my journey to learning about powerlessness was a long journey for me. Short for some people, but long for me. Because I grew up in a nice family. We moved around a lot. My dad designed computers for IBM. And, you know, by the time I was in sixth grade, I lived in Michigan, New York, California, Germany, and Florida. And we settled in Florida, and my dad was on the design team at Boca with the original PCs, and he always worked at this point because that was what they did. And, you know, I tried to do things in my life to get my dad's attention. I became a good athlete. I became a decent student. But, you know, by the time I got to high school, I never felt like I fit in with everybody else. I never felt okay. I know there's this old timer, Denny Lawrence, from Youngstown. He used to tell this story, and he said, you know, when I was born, I was a good orange. And I grew up, and as I started to grow up, I figured that I didn't like oranges. I liked bananas. And so to be around bananas, I knew I had to become like them. So I started dressing like a banana and going where bananas go and doing the things bananas do. And all of a sudden, I became, on the outside, a pretty good banana. And all of a sudden, I started attracting bananas. Well, you see, as soon as bananas got close to me and figured out I was an orange, they went away. And that's kind of the story of my life. Is that by the time I got into high school, I always thought I wasn't hip enough, slick enough, or cool enough, and I had to be something else. And whether it was the athlete or the student or the scholar or whatever it was something else. And my parents were teaching me values and morals and, you know, trying to teach me how to be a good citizen of the day. And I had this little job at a restaurant up at the end of the street. I was like 14 years old or something, washing dishes. And one Sunday night, I came out of that restaurant, and there was a case of cooking wine sitting by the back door. And without much thought, I picked up that gallon of cooking wine, I put it in the linen bag I was taking out back, I took it out back, set it out there. The next morning, had my athletic duffel bag, I grabbed that gallon of wine, and I jumped on the bus and went to school. Now, it's interesting because at this point in my life, I'd seen alcohol around. My dad was and mom were not alcoholics, but they had parties where they got drunk. There were drunken escapades. There was drunken behavior. Doesn't mean they were alcoholics. And you see, I take that cooking wine, and by the time I got off the bus, a couple people knew that I had it. And all of a sudden, in the morning of the day, people started coming up to me and saying, "Hey, Walt, you want to go out to lunch together? How about if we skip class together? You want to hang out after school? What are you doing?" You see, all of a sudden, before I ever took a sip of alcohol, alcohol started giving me something I wanted. A very powerful thing that I wanted, that I craved, was others' attention. And by the time I took that warm cooking wine that day and put it up to my lips in the bathroom of the school in Florida, and you can imagine how wonderful that wine was, And I felt that burn on my lips and felt it go into my belly. And I felt the explosion that happened for me. And you see, alcohol painted a pretty picture for a guy like me. Because all of a sudden I was able to talk to you and connect with the world, and I wasn't alone anymore, and all of a sudden people wanted to be around me. It was all the things I wanted for so long. You see? And I sought that for a very, very long time. That day changed my life. So, at this point, I was a straight-A student going to a special school that I was bused 50 miles away from my house to. You see? And I proceeded over the next 3 years to probably cut around 1,800 classes, which is about three a day, average. Alcohol became real important in everything I did, whether it was hanging out or whether it was playing sports. I'd show up to play sports drunk. I mean, it was just that simple. I drank all the time at this point. And you know, by the time I got out of this high school, all my friends, they're going to Harvard and Yale and MIT, and me, I'm going to the beach. I'm going to take a year off and think about this thing here. You see? Because I bought into what the movie said a guy from Fort Lauderdale was supposed to do. You hang out on the beach all day, you drink in the bars all night. That's what you're supposed to do. And you know, I went to this special school, and this special school was in Davie, Florida. And there was a lot of very influential people that went there, and a lot of people from the New York area that moved to Florida went there. And while I wasn't working after school and hanging out, one of my good friends from school started telling me about ways to make money. Because after all, I needed a little more money. And, you know, everything I did was around alcohol and drugs. You know, we're talking about 1975, you know. I mean, the party was on. And living in South Florida, the best way to make money was getting on a plane and flying to Peru or Colombia and coming back and, you know, not knowing whether you were going to come back or not. And it was a very good way to make money. And my brother and I both got into the drug trade. And I spent the next few years importing drugs from South America. And, you know, that doesn't mean I'm an alcoholic. That's drunken behavior for me. It's only drunken behavior. There's a big difference between drunken behavior and alcoholism. You see? I can pour alcohol in a 5-year-old and they're going to exhibit drunken behavior. Doesn't make them alcoholic. Okay? There's a reason I'm an alcoholic, and I'll get to it. So as time went on, things started getting very crazy. And by the time I was 19 years old, I darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. And I don't know why I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still can't remember much about it at this point, but I know I went. And I went to 4 or 5 meetings. And that started me on a journey of not understanding any other lifestyle but the party, but yet always hating the violence that came with it. Because I lived in a very violent life at this point. And it was pretty crazy, because I get back to this story about being an orange. I wasn't brought up to be this kind of guy. I wasn't brought up to be a tough guy to carry a gun every day and to hurt people. You see, this was me being a banana on the outsides, trying to be hip and slick and cool. Because that's what you were supposed to be in South Florida. You were supposed to be the guy that, you know, was doing cocaine every day and drinking in the bars. And, you know, I mean, I'll never forget. By the time I was out of high school, I valued my worth by how much I could drink. Could I drink more than you? And I thought that was a real important thing. And I still will never forget the night I'm sitting in JW's lounge in Deerfield Beach, Florida, and this guy sitting next to me says, "Man, you're looking pretty drunk." I said, "Yeah, it's been a long day." He goes, "Well, here, take a little bit of this and you'll be able to drink all night." And I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, it's miracle stuff. No kidding." I snorted a little bit of this stuff. I drank all night. It was wonderful. Within a week, I didn't know whether I was drinking to snort the powder or snorting the powder to drink. You know, I mean, it gets a little confusing there at times in our alcoholism. Especially for a guy like me. But see, here's the thing. All the car wrecks I had, the jails, all the stuff I did, all the people I hurt, didn't make me an alcoholic. None of that makes me an alcoholic. Because maybe nobody else in this room had a similar experience. And yet, most of us probably profess to be alcoholics. You see, that's the beautiful thing about God. You see, because God gave us this wonderful program. And He did it in a strange way, because He didn't give it to the spiritual gurus. And He didn't give it to the doctors or the lawyers or the priests. He didn't give it to any of them. He took a stockbroker and a proctologist and put them together in Akron, Ohio to figure this thing out. If that ain't God, I don't know what is. Let me tell you. Because believe me, if He would have gave this to a priest or He would have gave it to a doctor, this Alcoholics Anonymous would have never happened. Never. They wouldn't have had the credibility that Alcoholics Anonymous has today unless Bill and Bob came about the way they did and the way this wonderful fellowship has developed. Because when you think about the history of the drunk before 1935, there was only one period in time that a drunk ever had a chance at a normal life. Only one period. You see, in 1850, there was a little society called the Washingtonians. And they grew to about 600,000 members. And the Washingtonians got people sober. And they stayed sober. But see, the Washingtonians had a problem. Because they were the first, they didn't understand anything about what they were doing. And all of a sudden, there were meetings that were based on slavery and not slavery. And meetings that were political. And meetings that were all about times of the state of the times. And they loused it up. And guess what? Within 10 years, they were gone. Gone. And if you don't think that can't happen to Alcoholics Anonymous, look at the state of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I say the state is bad. Alcoholics Anonymous is in trouble today. And I believe that with every soul and fiber of my heart. I've been sober 37 years and 9 months. And I've never thought of Alcoholics Anonymous as being weak. And today it's weak. I feel so sorry for the drunks that are dying out there. Last year over 100,000 died. And Alcoholics Anonymous is weak. I go to meetings that used to be 200 people and there's 20 people today. I feel responsible. What part am I doing? You see, what I found out about alcoholism is it's real simple. And I don't go by necessarily the definition Dr. Silkworth had, because I take umbrage at what the way he puts it. I don't believe that he understood alcoholism the way we do today. And there's very few things, I'll tell you, in the big book that I take a little bit of problem with. Because I believe in the big book. It saved my life. But see, where he gets into the point in the doctor's opinion about talking about an allergy. You see, I had a problem because for me, alcoholism was this simple. Every time I quit sober, I picked up a drink again. Every time I quit sober, I picked up a drink again. And the problem I have with Dr. Silkworth is he says, after you take a drink, the phenomenon of craving comes on, and that's where the allergy is. Well, why are we here then if we can stay away from the first drink? Why are we here tonight? If I could stay away from the first drink, I wouldn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I come to AA because I can't stay away from the first drink. You see? I come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I have a mental obsession followed by a physical compulsion that causes a weird mental twist in my brain that makes me drink every single time. Every single time I drink. Left to my own device. It got to the point where I could stay sober in most treatment centers. Not all of them, but most of them. And I'd spend 90 days in a treatment center, and the 91st day I'd be drunk. And I didn't understand why. I didn't understand why. It didn't make no sense. I tried my best and I couldn't stop. In and out of this program for 8 years. I couldn't stop. And it kept getting worse for me. And when I say it kept getting worse, it kept getting worse. Not only the things around me got worse and got more unmanageable as my powerlessness became more evident, but I mentally got worse because I didn't believe my lies anymore, that it was going to be different, that I knew better now. You see, I didn't believe that anymore. I'd tell you I was an alcoholic. Not much I could do about it. Just is the way it is. It is the way it is. You see, I got into a place where I did not believe that Alcoholics Anonymous would work for a guy like me. I didn't believe it whatsoever. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that every time I quit drinking, I could not stay quit. I don't care if it was 5 minutes, 3 hours, 3 days, or a year. I would always find some way to mentally screw my mind up that made it feel that I could take that first drink and it'd be okay. Every single time. Every time. I made great decisions. I'm coming home from Fort Lauderdale one night. I've been drinking all day long. We were eating Quaaludes. We were having fun. You know, we're down at the Button, hanging out. It's great, right? I'm coming down 95 there in Fort Lauderdale, and you get to Pompano, and there's a double bridge at Copens Road. I go over the first bridge. I'm in this nice Volkswagen. It's a good time to take a nap at 3 in the morning, right? I pass out and hit a light pole on the next bridge, go off the bridge. I break every sternum away from my, every rib away from my sternum. I'm in the hospital for 6 weeks. My best thinking was, geez, I've got a real problem with driving. I think I should stop driving so much. I took the bus for 2 years. 2 years. Because not drinking was not an option. Was not an option. I was willing to go to any length for my alcohol. Any length. And every time I quit, I couldn't stay quit. Every time I quit, there would come that first drink again. Every single time. You see, the old timers, when I came to AA, told me, the only thing you got to do, kid, is not take that first drink. You don't hear it much anymore. I don't. I go to a lot of meetings still. I go to 5, 6, 7 meetings a week still. And I don't hear that a lot. Stay away from the first drink. Don't take the first drink. Well, how the hell am I going to do that? I can't stay away from the first drink. You see? I can't. I've tried. And we get to November 84, and I'm hopeless at this point because I know Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. I know the treatment centers don't work. And I know that I'm going to drink no matter what. My business partner that I've been doing things with for years was arrested, and they went to the grand jury. My name was mentioned 22 times at the grand jury, and I went home that night thinking I was going to be indicted the next day. Jimmy served 22 years in prison for what he did. I got Alcoholics Anonymous. I've often wondered what Jim would have given to get AA. You see, he served 22 years in prison and he was killed 6 months after he got out. I've often wondered that. Especially those nights when it's cold and it's snowy out and a new guy calls and says, man, I could use a meeting tonight. See, you guys don't have the benefit of seeing who I was that day. Judy does. You see, I had very little value as a human being left at that point. And I knew that. And I sat with my sponsor at a Denny's in Willoughby. My sponsor looked at me and said, do you know alcoholism is a good person's disease? And I said, you got to be shitting me. There ain't no way. There ain't nothing good about me. I hurt people. I do bad things. She said, no. You see, that's drunken behavior. It's not alcoholism. It's drunken behavior. Alcoholism is a whole different thing than drunken behavior. You see, alcoholism is about powerlessness. Alcoholism is about the inability to have a choice over your behavior. The definition of powerlessness. I couldn't choose whether I took a drink or not. And that's a terrible place for a man to be. Terrible. They put me in this jitter joint, and I still didn't believe in AA. And once I got out of this jitter joint, it was December, and they shipped me out to Ashtabula, and it took me like 3 months to figure out I was still in America, you know? Snow up to here. And, oh, God. I showed up in Ohio. I got the upgrade. I had the black garbage bag at least, but I got shorts and flip-flops, and it's December. You know, I mean, it was pretty rough those first couple years. Pretty rough. So I get in the halfway house and I'm trying to figure out how can I change my life? I can't do this no more. I just can't live the way I was living no more. And New Year's Eve comes and they have a little celebration at the halfway house, and I wake up the next morning and the guy next to me had slit his wrist and killed himself. And I knew the pain he was feeling. I knew that pain. Because I didn't think there was anywhere for me to go. There was no redeeming me, and I couldn't take doing the things I was doing anymore. It disgusted me, but I couldn't take it. And I hated sober. Any alcoholic that tells you they like sober, they're full of crap. They're full of crap. I come to these meetings so I don't drink. I like to drink. I like drunken behavior. I don't like alcoholism. You see? I still get a kick out of going to the bars sometimes and watching drunken behavior. Okay? It's funny sometimes. People act stupid. But see, alcoholism is a whole different thing, you see? And as I went through this treatment center, I didn't believe in AA, and I'd come to these meetings and I'd listen to these leads, and I'd say, man, that's great for you, but it don't work for me. It's great for you. I got a calendar on the day. I'm doing like jail time at this treatment center because I know I'm healing up. I'm not bleeding anymore out of places you're not supposed to bleed out of, and putting on some weight, and I'm feeling good. Counting those days. See, I didn't believe in AA. I didn't believe in AA. Because everything I'd been exposed to, AA had failed me. It hadn't worked. There was no reason for me to believe in AA. But I saw some people that were sober around me. And I knew it worked for them. And that's a bad place to be. Trying to learn about powerlessness and not believing that you can do anything but be powerless. Because that's what powerlessness means. You see? If you read the first four... If you read the foreword to the first edition... I always say the first foreword to the first edition. It's the foreword to the first edition. If you read the first paragraph in there, and if you don't know it by heart, you're missing out something in sobriety. Because it goes on to say, we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And it goes on to say that the big book was written to precisely show us how these steps work. Not in a roundabout way, not in 1,000 ways to stay sober, not in you have your way and I have mine. I don't read the white part of the book, sorry guys. I read the black part. It doesn't change. There's no myths and no legends in there. There's facts for me. So I'm in this halfway house and I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to do. I'm complying at the minimum. You know, my counselor wakes me up at 5 in the morning and he tells me that they had found my brother and he'd been executed and they found him in the Everglades. And he's my little brother. You see, it's a bad place to be when you've got one leg wanting to go to God and another leg calling you back. Because I truly believe that when you walk away from the devil and the life I was leading was nothing holy about it, that devil's going to try to get you back 3 times as hard. You see? And I'll never forget the kind people of Alcoholics Anonymous coming to that halfway house I was in and staying with me around the clock. And they'd say stupid things to me like, you know, you can't kill people and stay sober. I can't stay sober anyway, so what does that matter? Well, it's different. I get on the plane, I go to Fort Lauderdale to my brother's funeral, and AA's picked me up at the airport and took me to their house to stay. And I went to the funeral the next day, and one of my goombas kissed me on the cheek and told me, you killed my brother. And another one, in their kindness, put cocaine in my pocket that I didn't know about. See? And I'm back at this AA's house after the funeral, and I know what I have to do. The only way I can live with myself is to kill the people who killed my brother. It was the only rule I had to live on. I didn't have God. I didn't understand life. And I went into that bathroom in that AA's house and I'm like pacing in there not knowing what I'm going to do because I know what I got to do now. And I take my jacket off and out falls that cocaine on the ground. You see, that's my answer. Alcohol was never my problem. It was everybody around me's problem. You see? It was always my answer. Because alcohol painted a pretty picture for a guy like me. No matter how devastating the world got around me, alcohol painted a pretty picture for a guy like me. You know, at that moment, God came into my heart and touched me. And I picked up that dope and I threw it in the toilet and I flushed the toilet. I get down on my knees and I say, you know, God, either this AA shit works or it doesn't. I'm going to try. You see, my sponsor told me there were things you needed to do before you get to the steps. And that's kind of what I've been talking about here. You see, because before you can work a step in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are conditions that need to be fulfilled. If you read the first four chapters of the book, they explain it very clearly. But what it comes down to and how it works and why it's very clear, because it says a term, it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to work certain steps. Wow. Wow. You see, at that moment, I wanted what those guys had. I wanted their lifestyle. God rearranged me inside and changed me at that moment. I haven't drank since. You see, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous because it worked for me when I didn't think it would work ever. And so, now I joined up, and I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I go back to this halfway house in Ashtabula, and somebody has stole a magazine from me. I come out of a rage and a blackout in the middle of a group. I'm beating the hell out of the guy, and I just joined up AA, and they're throwing me out. Imagine that. They throw me out of the halfway house. I was kind of screwed up. I didn't understand the difference between treatment and AA. But I found out real quick. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous was there. When I got thrown out, Judy... bless her soul. Judy saved my life. Her and Jim took me in. The hell, Jim slept on the couch. I slept in the bed. Let me make phone calls and fed me and took care of me. And they found this halfway house called Painesville for me to go to. That's all I needed is more pain in my life, right? So I'm going to Painesville. You know, a few weeks after that, or months probably, I was talking to Jim and I said, you know, thanks for taking care of me the way you did and you slept on the couch. He said, hell, I slept on the couch so you wouldn't steal my TV. You know? But see, the power of God changed me, so I didn't do that. Because a month before that, or 2 months, I would have done that. It would have been normal for me to do that. So I went to this new halfway house, and my sponsor was always talking about, what's an AA you want? What's an AA you want? What's an AA you want? If you want what we have, do what we do. I'm just hearing this constantly. And finally, I go to this one meeting. And you know, I wanted AA, but there wasn't this passion for AA in me. Because I knew I was powerless, but I surely didn't really want what all you people had. I was kind of different still, you know. And I walk into this meeting called Wycliffe Wednesday one night. Actually, I want to tell you one other meeting. I was in the halfway house in Ashtabula. And it was a Sunday night. And they said, we're going to go to this meeting in Cleveland. And I go, okay, we're going. So they put us on this little short bus that was from the, said mental health on the side of it. Wonderful. And we're going to Cleveland. And we go down through Cleveland. And as we get to the city, I see the big city. And I'd never seen steel mills before. And there's smokestacks burning and stuff. And I'm like, whoa, that's a little different. And we pull up at this old church and we get out of the bus and there's a line of like 100 people outside this church, like a gauntlet you had to walk down, and every one of them shaking your hand and saying good things to you. And you get into this meeting and the meeting's like 3 hours long, comments for 2 hours. But you know what? These men and women there, I came to believe in them. I came to believe in what they said because of the way they said it. They believed in what they were saying, and you could tell it. They had conviction and passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. It meant something to them, and that inspired me. That inspired me because AA meant something to them. And you see, I walked away from that meeting that night and went to a few more meetings. I was looking for a home group because I wanted to be part of AA. I go into this meeting at Wycliffe Wednesday, and it's a big meeting, 300 people. All the women on the right side, all the men on the left side, and then there was a line of tables down the far left side. That was Murderer's Row. Okay? That's where all the old-timers sat. And I sat in the front of that meeting and I was a little nervous that night because it was so big. And after the meeting, some guy walked up and started playing on a piano up in the corner of the meeting. And another guy goes up to him and goes, man, you can't do that here. That's not what we do. You need to go talk to these guys. And next thing I know, I turn around, they're beating the hell out of each other, rolling around on the floor. I joined the home group. They had what I wanted, you see. They had that tough style of sobriety that I needed at that time. I felt comfortable in those rules. I know those rules. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous became something that became very, very important after that for me. I wanted what these people had, and I wanted to work the steps. And as I went to the steps at that point, I thought it was just about not drinking. And so when I worked the steps then, it was more like the way Dr. Silkworth talks about it. But you see, today as I look at my powerlessness, I look at it a little bit differently because I really believe that there are certain things I have an inability to make a choice over in my life. If you don't believe that, here's what I want you to do tonight. I want you to go home and take every glass out of your cupboards and put them where your plates are. And then take the plates and put them where your glasses are. Now, over the next week, I want to tell you how many times you're going to pick up a plate to get a glass of water. Okay? You're going to do it consistently. If you think you have choice over your life, you're nuts. We run on ritualistic patterns 90% of the time. Think about it. If we had to make decisions over everything we did in our lives, you couldn't drive a car because you wouldn't know where to move it left to right or move your left foot, right foot, look up, look at. Whew, too many decisions all at once. Our body doesn't do it that way. You see, we don't go that way. So for powerlessness for me is that inability to understand that my thinking is going to be wrong sometimes. That I don't have the ability to control my brain. Quite often I developed a way to tell my brain, shut the F up. You see, I do. I tell all my guys I sponsor, they need to learn how to tell their brains just to shut the F up. Because the bottom line is, our brains sometimes are going to tell us screwy things, especially early in sobriety. You see, we're powerless over our brains, we're powerless over other people, and we're powerless over ourselves. And to get to that place sober is an amazing place. But it didn't happen for me early on like that, to understand that it was a gift to understand our powerlessness, that it was a gift to understand that just because we wanted to do something didn't mean we were going to do that. But you know, one of the things that my sponsor did for me early on was gave me this little sign that said, through discipline you'll find true freedom. And as I worked the steps with some discipline, as I started to look at my life, my sponsor said, take step one and go back and look at the last 10 times you drank. And every time you quit, I want you to write about, why did you quit? What was going on? Why would you ever say the thing you love so much you're not going to do anymore? Why would you say that? And then I want you to think about your thinking between the time you said that and said you weren't going to drink, whether it's a minute, 5 minutes, an hour, a week, a month. I want you to think about that time and where your thinking was. Because your thinking had to change sometime in that time for you to get to a place to say, geez, I think a drink will make me feel good. It's my answer. It'll make me feel better. It'll make my life better. You see, that's what alcoholism is that we're powerless over the first drink. We have an inability to understand why we're powerless. On page 24 in the big book, it has one of those little squiggly things, you know, the italics part that, you know, Bill said, hey, you better listen to this dummy, you know. If it's not written clear in the big book, you need to pay attention. And on page 24, it's very clear that it says, for some reason, yet obscure, we've lost the power of choice over drink. Wow. How many times do you go to these meetings and hear these people say, boy, they chose to go back out. Those people don't understand alcoholism, do they? If I have a choice over alcohol, I'm not an alcoholic. The big book says there's four classes of drinkers, clearly, if you read chapter 2. And the heavy drinkers can get real confusing to some people, but it's real obvious to me. My buddy used to say it this way. You think you're a heavy drinker? Great. Here's what I want you to do. For the next 30 days, I want you to take one shot of whiskey. Just one. Have an appetizer before dinner every night. And if you can do that without thinking about a second drink, you're not an alcoholic. Makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. Because for me, I'm going to think about that next drink because it's my answer. It's going to give me the relief for the confusion that's going on in this insane brain of mine. It's so important to understand powerlessness. The 12 and 12 goes as far, and Bill has written in the 12 and 12, it goes as far to say the only step we can work 100% is the first step. The only step. And you see, because I was powerless, because I was doing these things, everything in my life was nuts. Everything was unmanageable. Because I couldn't stay away from that first drink, nothing went well for me. I got to tell you, one time, and again, this is really drunken behavior, but one time I had a great job working for IBM where my dad was the lead design engineer, right? I was there 9 months. I worked my butt off harder than anybody else. But the manager knew I was a druggie. And he didn't hire me, knowing my dad was the boss there. That's how bad it was. You see? Powerless. I couldn't stop if I wanted to. I couldn't be good if I wanted to at that point. Being unmanageable? It's so important to understand. Because, you know, even though I put down the drink, that didn't mean my life got a lot better right away. Because I did a lot of damage to me. And even life was unmanageable sober for a long time for me. But we'll talk a lot more about that as time goes on here. Okay, we're getting close. So for me, if you look at the powerlessness of the big book, it's basically the fact for me is that I can't stay away from the first drink. and that every time I try, for some reason, there's a mental twist in my brain that I pick up a drink again. And when I pick up that drink, nothing in my life goes well. Nothing goes well long term. I want to thank you guys for asking me to come here. Hopefully, I didn't offend too many people, you know. But, you know, I want to thank you for this privilege because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love everything they've done for me. I love the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous gave my wife 20 years of sobriety before she passed. And I love the fact that my boys will never see me drink, hopefully, a day at a time. And I've raised two young men that both have college educations, that both are really good citizens, and they're stellar employees. And that's really important to me. Thank you for being so kind and listening.
Well, thank you very much. Ryan Alcoholic.
Ryan.
Hello. Wow. I'm going to be thinking about that until next Thursday, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people in this room will be too. That was powerful, man. I really appreciated that. We got a couple minutes here for some Q&A. Does anyone in this room or on Zoom have some questions for Walt? No one? Okay. We'll save them for next week, I'm sure. Thanks again, Walt. We appreciate it.